This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of I Could Be Wrong, But I Doubt It, Why Jesus is Your Greatest Hope on Earth and in Eternity, by Phil Robertson. Available now everywhere you get audiobooks.
You're listening to Quick to Listen. Each week, we go beyond hashtags and hot takes to discuss a major cultural event. I'm Morgan Lee. I'm an associate digital media producer here at Christianity Today, and I'm joined today by journalist extraordinaire Ted Olson.
Hey, Morgan.
I know you have editorial capacities, too, but I feel like this is like a journalism week for you and a journalism day, as our audience will soon find out.
Yeah, it's always fun to be on Quick to Listen when Mark has to travel, so glad to be back.
All right, so who's joining us today, Ted?
We are joined by Ben Dooley. He's a reporter based in Beijing, China, but the reason we want to talk to him today is for a piece that he wrote back in 2014 for Mother Jones Magazine, a major piece there called Who's Behind Newsweek. We'll get into that shortly, but welcome to Quick to Listen, Ben.
Hi, Ted. Hi, Morgan. Good to be on.
Great to have you, Ben. All right, so I'm sure our audience is very intrigued about why we're having you on the show for a piece that was written in 2014, and we're going to get into it right now. Last week, Newsweek magazine published a story that began with this editorial note. As we were reporting this story, Newsweek Media Group fired Newsweek editor Bob Rowe, executive editor Ken Lee, and senior politics reporter Celeste Cast for doing their jobs. Reporters Josh Keefe and Josh Shaw were targeted for firing before an editor persuaded the company to reverse its decision. The editorial note went on to laud that the editorial staff had felt that their reporting had been compromised. They accused Newsweek publishers of violating journalism ethics, such as showing parts of the drafts to subjects in the story. The editorial note said that the staff, quote, resisted their efforts to influence the story, and that finally their story was written and edited free of interference from company executives. At this point, you're probably wondering what the story is about and why we're talking about it today on Quick to Listen. So here's the headline of it. Why is the Manhattan DA looking at Newsweek's ties to a Christian university? We'll get to this question posed by the headline later on in the podcast, but we're talking about the story because Newsweek's owners don't just have strange and deep ties to a Christian college. They are part of a new religious movement with major ties to Korean and American evangelicalism. For the three of us on this podcast today, this story isn't new. Ted wrote a major article in 2012 called The Second Coming Christ Controversy. Here is the deck. David Jang, and by the way, David Jang's name will come up a little bit later, has been an increasingly influential figure in Asian and now American evangelicalism. He and his followers have founded media outlets and a Christian college and are key influencers in the World Evangelical Alliance. But many say he leads a group that has encouraged the belief that he's the second coming Christ. Is there any truth to these allegations? As we noted previously, in 2014, Ben authored a piece for Mother Jones called Who's Behind Newsweek? Why are the new owners so anxious to hide their ties to an enigmatic religious figure? I have personally never reported on Jang or his media properties, but full disclosure, from 2013 to 2014, I worked as a reporter for the Christian Post, an online newspaper that is also closely connected to David Jang. Today, we'll talk about what sparked these pieces and what's happened in the years since these reports came out. We'll bring you up to date on what's happening now in this complicated story, and as usual, explain its significance to the evangelical community. Ted, as you know, this show always starts out with gut checks, which is when we tell people how we really feel about particular stories. You know, we have a lot to unpack here, but let's start with the gut check that pertains to this editorial note that was published on Newsweek's site last week.
You know, I have a number of Google News alerts set up for David Jang and for his various media entities. The gut check on this one was that I was a little bit surprised. I mean, this is a story that hit big in kind of media Twitter, and a number of, you know, media reporters are definitely following the Newsweek story very, very closely, with some very good reports coming out in a lot of different outlets. And it was like, wow, people are actually paying attention to this, and this actually may be a moment where a lot of the good reporting that's been done over the last decade is finally paying off. It's always a little bit frustrating as a reporter to devote a lot of time time to an investigative report, and then have it land very, very softly to not see a lot of the fruits of your work, and to be like, I don't know if anyone cared about that story we put out into the world. And then so now to see it, you know, get referenced in a few of these other outlets, and also just to see like, okay, now maybe something will happen with this David Jang community and people will understand what it's about. It's frustrating to see what's happening with Newsweek, but there's also a bit of a happiness to see like some of this work may be actually making a difference.
My gut check is definitely one where I'm like, wow, it's fascinating to see real life impact in real time. How often do you get to see stories actually leading to the end of people's jobs that worked on them? Though in this case, arguably the people who should have lost their jobs did not lose their jobs. And the people who were trying to, you know, follow through with ethical commitments that we have as journalists are the people who did pay the price for their jobs. But that is a fascinating thing to play out. I think similarly to you, I am really curious about what this is going to actually mean for this entire group of people that we'll be looking into really soon, when there has been significant reporting that's come out about the wheelings and dealings that they have been involved with. And none of it has really seemed to been the thing that ultimately discredits them or makes their business model fall apart or, you know, prosecutes if appropriate. And so it'll be interesting to see where this goes. So, Ben, you know, today we're talking about something that is extremely complicated and probably really fresh and new for a lot of the listeners on the show. So I just want to start out by talking about who are the key players in this story that we need to know.
From the Newsweek side of things, we have the Newsweek Corporation, of course, and a company above it called IBT, International Business Times, which has recently rebranded itself as the Newsweek Media Group. That has been headed by a couple of people, three people actually, a guy named Etienne Uzek, a guy named Jonathan Davis, and a guy named Dev Prad. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but so these are three media executives who've been in charge of these companies that bought Newsweek in 2013. They, in turn, are connected to, this is all going to be very complicated, this is huge network, like web of connections with different groups and so on and so forth. But they're connected to an evangelical Christian college in California called Olivet University, which was founded by a Korean pastor named David Jang. And I guess he, to me, has been sort of the focus of my interest in this story, but he hasn't really been, I think, much of a focus for people who are writing about the issue, people who are more interested in sort of the media industry implications of this story, as opposed to getting into, you know, who's behind Newsweek currently.
Ted, are there any other names that you might add to that?
Yeah, the main names you need to understand, certainly David Jang, who is this pastor from South Korea, who's now U.S.-based. And then a lot of names just to be aware of would be familiar ones to maybe some of our listeners would be Christian Post and Christian Today, which is kind of the U.K. version of the Christian Post, not to be confused with Christianity Today. A lot of people do online get confused between Christian Today and Christianity Today. But this organization has a ton of different names. Has a lot of different businesses. They do tend to reuse some names. So Olivet is a popular one, not to be confused with Olivet Nazarene University here in Illinois. But Olivet World Assembly is certainly one of their, is kind of an umbrella group for a lot of their church-based organizations. A lot of their tech organizations start with Vera, V-E-R-E, Vera Media or associated names. But yeah, they have a lot of things. They have Jubilee is another one that you see a lot of times. Jubilee World is kind of a Christian music company that they have. Recently bought the Orpheum Theater in St. Louis. But most of the kind of hub of a lot of their connections is this Olivet University that originally San Francisco based and now is building out into New York State.
I think that one thing I'd like to kind of clear up before we move any further is, what is the connection between this Korean ministry and these Western media outlets? And what I mean by that is, are these Western media outlets, for instance, an extension of their ministry, or are they a money-making part of that ministry?
My understanding is that it really depends on whether you're looking at internal secret documents that we've seen at CT and that also were quoted in some of Ben's reporting at Mother Jones, and what you see externally and in some of their PR things. Officially, there is not, you know, a direct connection. You cannot look at International Business Times About Us page or even, yes, their financial filings and say, you know, here is David Jang listed as founder and president in the way that you can, you know, open an issue of Christianity Today and see Billy Graham at the top of our kind of founder document. And when a few places have asked, you know, what is your connection with David Jang? Etienne and Davis and others have said, you know, he's our pastor, but we don't have any, you know, we don't have any real ties with him business-wise. But that also is not really the case. If you look at some of the internal documents, Jang has been very influential. He's certainly can be considered founder of International Business Times. It was his idea. He has made a lot of decisions in terms of the finances of the company, the hiring of staff. We didn't see a lot of evidence of editorial decisions that he was making, but a lot of the, you know, who's going to run this? Who are we going to pull over from Olivet University to work at International Business Times? What students are we going to use? Under what circumstances to work at some of these businesses?
I think to get to the heart of your question, why would this Christian university start a company like IBT? And the answer is money. They saw it as a source of income that would help fund their ministries. And also, there's a lot, I think this is more the case perhaps with Christian Post, there was a lot of talk in the community about using these media properties as a way to kind of increase David Jang's influence in the world globally, really. And, you know, whether that would be through using the company as a way to introduce him and his followers to important people, or to sort of change, you know, the discourse that is happening around any number of subjects. I think ultimately there hasn't been, if you ask anyone who's worked at Newsweek, there hasn't actually been much editorial interference, if any, from Davis or Uzak or certainly Jang. I think most people weren't even really aware that Jang was affiliated with the company, because his association is something that is denied. As Ted said, I mean, they say he's their pastor, but, you know, in terms of his actual role in the company, you know, IBT people there won't really admit that he had anything more than perhaps a kind of an advisory role.
Yeah, I think that one thing I'd like to kind of pull out here for our listeners is why exactly this link might be seen as nefarious as opposed to just another media owner who happens to be in ministry or doing something religious.
For me, it's, you know, there certainly you can point to organizations like the Washington Times, which is, you know, run by the Unification Church, or had been Unification Church, you know, the Moonies, also connected with bought UPI, you know, that wire service. In some cases, Christian Science Monitor was run by, you know, the Christian Science, you know, Church. But part of it also, part of the nefariousness is the denial of undeniable facts of the connections. That's one weird thing. Another aspect for me is what we focused on in the Christianity Today reports, which was this community's belief that David Jang is not just, you know, their pastor, but many top people in this religious community have believed and have encouraged others to believe that David Jang is what they call the second coming Christ, definitely a Messiah type figure. Now, that's different from the second coming of Christ. They believe he is a different figure from Jesus of Nazareth, but that he is a second coming Christ who has some sort of messianic purpose in the world right now. So that to Christianity Today is a heretical belief that we were rather surprised by.
Yeah, and I mean, that of course is a concern. You mentioned Reverend Moon of the Unification Church, and although David Jang has disavowed his relationship with Moon, I mean, he was in fact a member of the Unification Church, quite closely involved, according to the findings of a Japanese court. So there's that aspect as well. And in fact, a lot of what he's been doing, you can kind of see as him modeling his behavior, whether it's buying media properties, you mentioned the Washington Times and UPI, or other activities is involved in. He's been modeling himself on Reverend Moon, or at least that's what a lot of people who have been involved in the group believe. From my perspective, yeah, as Ted mentioned, one of the big issues here is transparency. As you said, you know, Christianity Today, it's upfront about the fact that Billy Graham was the, you know, the person who found it. In my own investigation, we found a lot of things that were frankly pretty disturbing. The fact that these groups were bringing people into the country illegally to work, essentially as, I mean, slaves, for lack of a better word, you know, they were paying them virtually nothing and just relying on the fact that they believed in David Jang as this messianic figure to essentially squeeze free work out of them. And we're talking about, you know, we're not talking about people washing dishes or something like that. We're talking about like really high-end legal work sometimes, programming, journalism, a lot of, you know, sort of white-collar jobs.
You talked about Olivet University, and I'm just wondering, what do we know about Olivet University? I mean, I presume that it's accredited and that it functions as an actual university.
That's a good question. It's honestly, it's hard to say. You know, I've spoken to professors who work there, and there are real students there. They're taking real classes, but all of the students that attend all of that, at least as of 2014 when my article came out, were members of this group, and they were almost to a person working in what they described as the business ministries of that are affiliated with David Jang's group. It is an accredited university. The accreditation, I mean, it raises a lot of questions, I think, about how universities are just accredited in general in the United States. There, particularly, this seems to be an issue with some religious universities, small religious colleges. But it's actually pretty easy to get an accreditation, as it turns out. And there are a number of colleges, not just religious ones, but that tends to be the case, that people can pay to attend. They get a student visa, they come here, and then they work. And the universities are not really offering any classes or any kind of formal education. You know, they're just a convenient way for people to get a visa to come to the U.S. There's not necessarily anything wrong with that. But sorry, I just don't want to get into the whole question of immigration, which is a different topic altogether. But
sure.
The point is that these people are not coming here for the purposes that they claim to be. And that seems to largely be the case with all of that, even though it is accredited, even though there are actual classes and actual professors. A lot of the activities that appear to be going on there, at least a few years ago, were not entirely above board.
Olivet is not a member of the CCCU, the Council on Christian Colleges and Universities. It is a fairly small school, and it is heavily foreign students, especially from East Asia, attending.
Almost exclusively.
Yeah, almost exclusively. You know, this is not an organization you're going to hear about in a lot of our circles at CT. They're not, you know, marketing to American evangelical students. They're pretty much trying to attract students from, you know, Korea and Singapore and China and various places. We have an article in Christianity Today about, you know, how students from, especially from China, are becoming a much larger presence on Christian colleges, how much Christian colleges are getting students from East Asia and are becoming increasingly dependent on those students because in most cases they pay full tuition. All of that in some ways was a precursor to that, where there's, you know, a fair bit of money coming into the school from these folks' parents. I think, Ben, your report had this as well. We talked to a number of students who came over. Their parents were already paying tuition, but the students would go back to their parents kind of over and over and over again, asking for more and more money that they had indicated was for their Olivet tuition, but actually was going into various Jang-related businesses.
Yeah. That was something that I heard from a number of people as well. That's you know, there's a constant demand for money on all of the members who are affiliated with Jang's groups. I mean, even recently, I haven't reported this, but you know, I got a note from someone recently who told me that as recently as what was it, November, I think, or December, they'd gotten a call to contribute. I think I don't remember a very large sum of money to the group, and a lot of that is coming through all of that in the form of tuition or donations.
Like some of these media properties where, you know, Newsweek hired a lot of, especially initially once IBT bought Newsweek, they populated it with a lot of very high-level journalists who were not at all part of the Jang network. In a similar way, there are people who have worked for Olivet who are not necessarily part of Jang's church. There are a number of people who may be somewhat connected to Zhang, but who have not ever had a belief that Zhang is the second coming Christ. So, and I would say there's a lot of people, this is apart from the Olivet thing, this is just larger in this kind of Zhang network. There are a lot of people who attended, you know, some of these Zhang churches or attended a number of these Zhang related Bible studies who never heard or were never taught or who were never encouraged to believe that Zhang was the second coming Christ. This was something that by all accounts in our reporting was something that, that you had to have gone through a lot of the Bible studies and a lot of these, what they called these 3x3x3, you know, like 9 hour a day Bible study and prayer sessions. And you would kind of gradually be led to this increasingly kind of apocalyptic Bible studies. And people would not kind of come out and say, hey, David Zhang is the second coming Christ. They would kind of lead you to, you know, these beliefs like there is going to be a second coming Christ. And then it kind of, when you would finish this program, they would say, you know, do you know who the second coming Christ is? And it would be up to the person to say, well, it must be David Zhang. And then they would be told, well, now you have made the confession. Now you need to write this letter to Zhang or to Zhang's lieutenants saying, you know, I now realize that you are the second coming Christ. And kind of the model that they're pointing to is kind of Peter's confession to Jesus that he is the Christ. So there's a lot of people in this world that we talk to, which I talked to a lot of people who said, yeah, I did believe for quite some time that Zhang was the second coming Christ. Or I talked to one person who's like, I made the confession, but I never really believed it. And I talked to some other people that were like, I did never get that far. I didn't hear that. I had done some of the Bible studies, but I didn't ever hear that David Zhang was the second coming Christ. So they seem to have closed that network, seems to have stopped around the time that some of the reporting on the Zhang community began. It doesn't seem like there's been a lot of newer people brought into that belief. So I think it's an open question a little bit about whether this group is a group that has a lot of businesses to kind of, with the end result being religious, you know, to proclaim Zhang as this messianic figure, or whether the kind of messianic stuff in the Zhang community has served the purpose of building the business side of creating a lot of businesses. People will work harder and will work cheaper if they think they're working for a messiah than if they just think they're, you know, grabbing page views so we can sell more ads.
That was something that had sort of been phased out because I think maybe perhaps it was considered too radical. It was maybe drawing too much attention. I can't really speak to the rationale. Yeah, I mean, I think the only person who actually knows the answer is David Zhang himself. I mean, certainly he has been preaching. He preached this idea of there being a flood. He was expecting a flood to come. I mean, he had this idea that, you know, the flood was not literal, but like a metaphorical one. It was a flood of information. And it was, as Ted said earlier, it was going to result in some kind of an apocalypse, and a new society was going to kind of rise up out of that. And that society was going to, you know, be led by the members of his group. This is a question that I've asked myself as well, you know, like what is the point of all of this at the end of the day? I mean, certainly they're making money, but are they making money for Zhang because does he really believe the stuff he's saying, or is he just a huckster? I don't know.
Yeah. And it's curious also that we never found any indication that Zhang himself made this, you know, said, I am the second coming Christ. There, he had a number of lieutenants, some people who were very close to him that kind of managed that teaching. But we got a lot of, you know, formal denials of David Zhang says, I've never teach this. And in fact, we also in our reporting, I should say, I don't think I've mentioned his name. Ken Smith was my co-author on most of these CT articles. We also found indications of Zhang formally saying, you know, I'm not the second coming Christ. You shouldn't be teaching this. That was odd, but we certainly see after that teaching that people were still being taught that. And the other thing is this group has never publicly or even, you know, formally or informally come out and said, yes, we held this belief and that was crazy and we've renounced it, despite all the evidence and all of the people, you know, who've come out and said, I believed this, I was taught this. The top echelon of this group still claims that was never a teaching in this group.
This episode of Quick to Listen is brought to you by the Christian Standard Bible, a translation that is both faithful to the original languages and really easy to read. You can learn more about the Christian Standard Bible at csbible.com/CT. This is Quick to Listen host Morgan Lee, joined by Trevin Wax, Bible and Reference Publisher for Lifeway Christian Resources and Holman Bibles. Hey, Trevin.
Glad to be with you guys.
How does one go about pulling together a translation team after they've announced that they're going to do a Bible translation?
The original translation team was, you know, more than 100 scholars from more than 17 different denominations and non-denominational churches. You want Bible scholars who are experts in their fields. Also, you want people that are like-minded in their regard for the authority and the sufficiency of Scripture. One of our translation committee members talks about how, in one of the early meetings that he was in, how some of the other members of the translation committee, when they were discussing sort of the weight and the responsibility of Bible translation, were moved to tears and were weeping in those meetings, just thinking about the amazing privilege and honor and responsibility it is to translate the Word of God.
This episode of Quick to Listen was brought to you by the Christian Standard Bible. Go to csbible.com/ct to find the right Christian Standard Bible edition for you.
This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Now and Not Yet. Pressing in when you're waiting, wanting, and restless for more. Written and narrated by best-selling author Ruth Cho Simons, Now and Not Yet shows us how to embrace the biblical truth that someday is made up of thousands of right now. Discern how the difficult parts of our lives are actually a unique gift by discovering 5 ways to flip the script on a hard season and to live faithfully in the tension between what is and what is not yet. Now and Not Yet is available everywhere audiobooks are sold. Visit thomasnelson.com/audio to learn more.
So I do want to, again, back up a little bit more, if only because part of the reason that we're talking about this story right now is that this ministry has made its way to the West in the past 15 years. What is your guys' understanding of what this ministry looked like before that? You know, I know in some of the reporting that I've seen, there's accounts of stuff happening in Japan and in China and in Singapore, if I recall correctly. So, you know, this is before that seemed like there were these like dabbling in media or dabbling in higher education. And so are we just kind of to understand this as like one of many Korean ministries that had picked up a following with different other Asian countries?
It's a good thing to note that, I mean, this is a global organization. It's literally everywhere. It's in Africa. It's in Eastern Europe. It's in Australia, Singapore. It's hard to say how many people are actually members. And I don't think the membership is particularly large, but it's an extremely ambitious group. I mean, David Jang had this vision for having an all that campus in every country in the world and every state in the United States, which, I mean, in some ways you kind of have to laugh at that kind of an idea because it's such a grandiose one. But, you know, I mean, in some ways they've been incredibly successful. They've really managed to, you look at the business they've built with IBT. I mean, I've been a journalist for a while now, and in the last few years, people talk to me about IBT all the time, you know, because it's everywhere. The origins of the group were in Korea. For whatever reason, I'm not sure exactly why. I mean, I've heard some theories. There are a lot of messianic groups in Korea, in South Korea, I should say. And it spread from there, I think, first to China and through Asia, as you said, but then, into Europe and the Americas. You know, there are members in Argentina and Mexico.
And when we're talking about this type of stuff, are we talking about denominations? I mean, when I see something along the lines of Second Coming Christ, that feels cult to me. But I don't know if there's other beliefs or practices that might have indicted them previously before that.
The main aberrant teaching here is this teaching that David Jang is the Second Coming Christ. The Bible studies that I saw leading up to that teaching, and a lot of the sermons that I heard or saw transcripts of, you know, a lot of it is very orthodox. A lot of it would, you know, fit very well with a lot of evangelical teachings. They have a network of churches here that they just call Presbyterian. Yeah, it's a Presbyterian network, and in a lot of cases, you would look at their teachings and say, seems like another Korean Presbyterian church body. It seems all normal. some of the practices have been similar to more what you would call, you know, traditional cults. I don't know if that seems like an oxymoron, but certainly I heard from a number of former members who had been at University of California campuses, you know, foreign national students, and they were approached by someone from the Olivet world, encouraged to attend Bible studies, were increasingly isolated from their friends at this other campus, and then were fully drawn into this Olivet world. So that is kind of an approach that's shared by a number of cults or new religious movements or whatever phrase you want to use. And what's interesting is we talked to some folks who were Chinese, and they said, we were new to all of this. I mean, Christianity was entirely new. So they're like, you know, like, you tell me that there was this guy 2,000 years ago, Jesus, and that he was, you know, God, and then he was crucified, and he came back 3 days later. Like, the idea that this new guy is, you know, second coming Christ, that's not at all crazy compared to all the stuff that I was learning about what millions of Christians believe around the world. So they're like, it was a fairly easy jump to hear about David Jiang as second coming Christ from the folks who had told me about, you know, Jesus as Lord.
I wanted to bring up one thing that was pretty relevant to when I worked at the Christian Post, which was that the Christian Post offices were on the same floor as the World Evangelical Alliance, which, from what I understand now working here at Christianity Today for the past couple of years, is a very important organization for us that we often use to kind of understand who the other evangelical groups are in different countries around the world, and to kind of give us a pulse about what evangelicalism looks like in some of these different countries. I'm kind of curious, Ted, about what you found out about this relationship between the WEA and David Jiang, and maybe what the current status of that is.
People may be familiar with the National Association of Evangelicals here in the U.S. The World Evangelical Alliance is kind of the collection of all of those national associations worldwide. It's this big umbrella group. Fairly important over the years. We did find, you know, when we did our reporting in 2012, the connections between the WEA and the Jiang community were seriously, seriously intertwined. Most of the WEA communication staff was provided or had come through the Olivet connections. A lot of the interactions that you would have with WEA were people from Jiang's community, but even people who had not come out of Jiang's community had developed very strong financial ties to the Jiang folks. So in some cases, having their apartment provided by the Jiang community. So it was really close. And as we started to do our reporting, there was strong defenses of the Jiang community from WEA leadership. That said, after our article came out, there has been massive turnover at the WEA. The WEA in 2018 is very different than the WEA in 2012, and it is to me an open question about what those ties are currently. David Jiang, I know, still has some ties, still has some connections, but you don't see the Jiang connected names come up in press releases. You don't see WEA relying on Jiang connected businesses for web design quite so much, and all of these things. So has there been a distancing? I don't know. But there certainly is a difference in personnel. I would definitely characterize it as a different relationship in 2018.
Are there any other notable footholds in the mainstream evangelical world that you would like to point out?
It's tricky, right? Because we're Christianity Today, and the Christian Post is another media organization. And one of the responses that they have had throughout all of our reporting is, CT, Christianity Today is just jealous. They're just trying to attack one of their competitors. You know, this is, you know, flatly untrue, but that's one of the arguments that they have made. But it is interesting, when we were doing some of our look at the Christian Post and what the Jiang connections were with the Christian Post, there's a number of people at the Christian Post, a lot of people at the Christian Post, who, you know, are unaware of Jiang connections. Their executive editor is Richard Land, who was, you know, one of the most prominent Southern Baptist leaders. He had the position that Russell Moore now has as head of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. And certainly he was on, you know, paid staff as executive editor of the Christian Post. There were other people on the editorial board of the Christian Post that, when we contacted them, they were unaware that they were on the editorial board of the Christian Post. And there were other people who said, yeah, I think I was asked to do something once upon a time, but I haven't heard from them in, you know, several years. So, yeah, so the relationships between some top evangelical leaders and the David Jang community, sometimes they're much closer than you think. And sometimes people are surprised that they appear on websites or appear to be endorsing this group. And again, I do think things have shifted a little bit since some of these reports have come out. There has been some quietness, although there are a lot of things about this group that seemed to be going underground, and then all of a sudden they bought Newsweek.
Ben, maybe you can bring us up to speed right now and say what's kind of going on with the district attorney in New York.
Yeah, I wish I knew. There's an investigation into Newsweek, or the Newsweek Media Group, more specifically, the company that owns Newsweek magazine. I have had a little bit of insight into what's going on through some connections I made when I was reporting the previous article, but I can't say really anything more than what's been in the media already, which is basically that there was a raid on Newsweek's offices by the New York District Attorney, and apparently they were interested in some computer servers that were in the office. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of days ago that suggested that perhaps this raid was related to questions about some loan fraud that may have occurred, and that fraud is related to those servers. I suspect, I've been looking, you know, through some public documents related to their finances, and it seems that the servers were paid for by loans from some small regional banks. That's something that the Wall Street Journal mentions as well. It looks like there's a company called Oikos Networks that's affiliated with the community. And one of the things that's quite interesting is that the community relies almost entirely on businesses that its own members have set up. So, they have a development corporation that takes care of developing properties that they've purchased. They have a law firm that helps them with their legal issues. And they have this company, Oikos Networks, which takes care of the back end part of their business, you know, servers and so on and so forth. So it seems that it might be related to that. I'm aware that there was previously a federal investigation into Olivet, but I think that has kind of never really went anywhere. So it's hard to know what's going to happen. It seems likely that there could be some kind of criminal charges brought at some point. And this has apparently been a 2-year investigation. And, you know, when an investigation goes on that long and you have a raid on your offices, you can only assume that it's quite serious. So who knows?
I think that Ted has mentioned a couple of small impacts that he's seen since we at Christianity Today dug around a little bit into this story. But I'm just curious, Ben, what small impacts may you have seen as a result of your reporting?
The thing for me that's been most gratifying is I get regular letters from people who read the report and as a result decided to leave the group. And that's the reason why I wrote the article was because I was hoping that people like the woman who I met, who first told me about this group, you know, they'd be able to read it and that would give them the courage to make a decision, perhaps to leave. And, you know, I'm not saying it's bad for everyone. It may not be, but a lot of people that I've spoken to about it tell me that it had a profoundly negative impact on their life.
Would either of you guys like to make predictions about where the story will end up?
I'm circumspect about making predictions because I thought that things were going to break loose a few years ago. All of that bought some property in New York State, this former psychiatric hospital, very old, fairly decrepit building that had a ton of asbestos. And they got in a lot of trouble with the EPA and with OSHA about the removal of that asbestos, which was done extremely illegally and in an extremely unsafe way. And they were facing a multimillion-dollar fine for that. And I thought, well, maybe something will happen now. And that fine was knocked down. It seems to have all been fairly much taken care of. Even when Ben's article, I thought, okay, now this is getting, you know, more serious attention. Maybe we'll see something happen. The Newsweek aspect does seem to have escalated this in a significant way. The DA's office the New York DA's office looking at this, that is, you know, more significant than just an article coming out here and there. This may be real. This may actually make a serious effect in this organization's ability to operate. But I've seen this organization succeed where I expected them to be on the on the downswing a number of times. So I'm loath to make predictions.
It's really remarkable. They're incredibly slippery. I mean, they've managed to just come through so much and survive, thrive even. This seems like it may be kind of the last curtain on, you know, David Jang's kind of play here, but it's just really hard to say. I think we demonstrated pretty clearly in the article that I wrote that he was behind a lot of what was going on there. But, you know, even now when you read the articles people are writing, they act as though it's an open question. So I do think that there will be consequences for someone, but I do kind of wonder, you know, who those people will be. And I don't necessarily think it's going to be maybe the people who are masterminding the whole operation, whoever they might be.
Well, and it seems if anything is going to end, it may just be the American chapter, given that you mentioned how big this ministry empire is at a global level.
Yeah, and we should mention that Jang, he's around 70 years old at this stage. So,
but he could live 30 more years. Billy Graham died
at 99. That's true. But there's a timetable. There's a clock ticking at that stage.
All right. Before we conclude this podcast, I'm just curious, should I mention anything about my own experiences at working at Christian Post?
Well, I mean, do you have experience? I mean, I am curious if...
Definitely.
I'm interested in what you saw there, especially in terms of the leadership there.
So as I mentioned earlier, I worked at the Christian Post from August 2013 to August 2014, and that was leading up to when I joined at Christianity Today. As I've mentioned to some of my current colleagues now, there were at times where I didn't know if something was the result of incompetence or some sort of larger conspiracy, if that makes any sense. So, for instance, there was not a strong effort to kind of build camaraderie or to train reporters or to really grow people's skills. And that was unclear if that was just because management had other things that they had to work on or if they legitimately just needed us to get traffic by whatever means necessary. And so there wasn't a real point in investing in us. I know that some of the reporting at IBT has focused on different traffic targets that reporters had to hit. We were encouraged to get about 200,000 views for our articles for the month that was like supposed to be the monthly goal. And then traffic above that was rewarded with different bonuses. There were times I don't think where I hit my goal, but I was not penalized. The pay was not fantastic, but again, that's actually really hard in this day and age to know whether that is a result of them abusing you or because journalism is just a very tricky profession and it's challenging to compensate people for that.
Right, especially in that period. I mean, you know, that this was the age of, get as many page views as you possibly could and click farms and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, I mean, that it was quantity over quality is what you're saying, which it certainly wasn't unique to the Christian Post.
Sure, and I know that at various times, if you can find Christian Post, if you're looking for some sports events to watch, and there's very clear articles that were set up just to grab Google's attention. But those were rarely written by people who were on the reporting and editorial staff. So, or at least the people that were in the newsroom physically with me were not the people that were doing these things that were so obviously a way to just get clicks in there. I do know that Ted is right about the narrative that was peddled about Christianity Today being jealous of the Christian Post. I remember having a conversation with one of my editors about that, and that was the stance that he took on that. I mean, overall, I actually thought it wasn't an unpleasant experience. I tell people that the best office that I ever had was in there because we overlooked the World Trade Center Memorial and had like giant windows, which I don't have a window in my office right now. So that's nice. And the other interesting thing was that it was an incredibly diverse newsroom when it came to our reporting staff. And I think that was because that they didn't necessarily care about pedigree in the same way that other places might care about prestige and pedigree. They needed people, again, who were going to churn out articles, even if they weren't going to be that super low-hanging fruit. And so we had different people from around the world and some people who had journalism experience and some people who really hadn't that had that much journalism experience. But it was actually kind of cool to be with, you know, the person who sat next to me, for instance, her parents were Zambian, but she was Australian. that was interesting, you know, and I had a couple of colleagues who were Caribbean American, and one of my closest friends in the newsroom was also a Bulgarian national too. So that was interesting. As far as people who worked on the IT side, that was a department that we really didn't interface with at all. It seemed that most of them were Korean nationals that didn't spend that much time interacting, maybe ever, with us reporters that were in the newsroom. But because of language barriers and seemingly just office culture barriers, there wasn't time that we would have connected with them very much. But that was kind of my experience of being there.
Well, one of the things we hear about Newsweek a lot is that, you know, the publishers seem not to know much about the journalism side, and there seem to just be kind of a secret group. Now, there's a lot of businesses that can make that complaint too, a lot of media businesses that can make that complaint. I am interested. I mean, you know, I know there are a number of people closely connected to the Jang community, you know, who were in top positions, you know, Michelle Vu, for example, at the Christian Post and others. I'm curious, were they fairly active in telling you what to write about, or was it you could write about whatever you wanted so long as you hit your page view targets?
I could write about a lot of things. If anything, it felt like maybe we don't want to promote this because it's outside of what evangelicalism is supposed to promote on this type of issue. But there was not a lot that would suggest that there was something larger than in a American Christian conservative type of approach. Yeah. But even that wasn't like too strictly enforced. The only thing I'll just say is that there's a line in Ben's piece that says, Andrew Clark, the man who registered IB Times in the United Kingdom, had registered all of its UK campus in 2006. And that was my supervisor and my boss.
Huh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of staff. I mean, you found this as well, Ben, right? That, like, people are moved all around these businesses all the time, depending on what's making money or hemorrhaging money or whatever. Which is one of the things that makes the claim that, like, oh, there's no real ties between Olivet and some of these properties, or between Jang and any of these properties, weird. Is you're like, well, you know, A, you're married to this person. You used to be the treasurer of this organization. You used to be, you know, the secretary of this organization. That's one of the weirdest things, is amid a paper trail, the response has often been to deny that the paper trail exists.
Given that, you know, your piece came out while I worked there and that Ted's came out before that, there was sometimes the sense of like, well, how would I tell if like Andrew was acting weird? Or like, right. how would there be any other telltale signs? I mean, most of the time we just ended up talking about soccer, for instance, because he was a huge soccer fan.
Right.
Yep.
You know, so anyway, that was just kind of my more germane experiences. All right. Well, thank you all for this really fantastic discussion. Since this has been a really long discussion, we're just going to breeze through the next part of the podcast, which is called Precious Moments. Precious Moments is when I ask everyone to share something that has brought them joy in the past week. Ted.
Putting together the commemorative issue on Billy Graham, that's something that, you know, there are two projects over my tenure at CT that I've worked on for a very long time. And one was the David Jang investigation that we've been talking about. But the Billy Graham special issue was much longer in the making. I started working on that, you know, nearly a decade and a half ago. And had some amazing contributors to that, some of whom have passed on by now, like John Stott and Chuck Colson and Richard John Newhouse. It was an honor to put that together over the years, and I'm thrilled to see it going out into the world. So my precious moment, really, sorry to make it worky, but I am really happy to see that serious celebration of Graham's life come out.
Awesome. Ted, where can people find you?
My Twitter handle is at Ted Olson. That's OLSEN.
For anyone that's interested in this particular magazine, I'm just going to make a note to this. If you are currently a subscriber, you will actually get this magazine as your April issue. If you would just like more information about the issue as a standalone piece, you can go to orderct.com/Billy Graham. All right, Ben, do you want to go?
Yeah, although it's going to start in kind of a dark place. It gets to a happy one. I was traveling last week in Xinjiang, which is in China's far west, and it's home to an ethnic minority group known as the Uyghurs, who are experiencing some really severe oppression at the hands of the Chinese government now. And I hope that your listeners will take some interest, if they get the chance, in them and seek out some information about them, because they're being persecuted for their religious beliefs. But while I was there, I had the opportunity to travel to a place called Shipton's Arch, which is the world's largest natural sandstone arch, big enough to fit the Empire State Building under it. You can fly a
Wow.
A passenger plane through it. Yeah. And it's just, it was a reminder that, you know, even in a place where there's a lot of darkness, there's also can be a lot of beauty.
Awesome.
Where can people find you online?
My Twitter handle is at Benjamin Dooley. That's Benjamin, D-O-O-L-E-Y.
All right. My precious moment was the fact that I got to go on a run yesterday in a t-shirt and shorts, which is not bad for February.
Spring is coming.
Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm going to say that spring is here right now, and I'm going to enjoy it while it lasts, and it's probably not coming. But it was great to just be outside, and I got to then sit outside after I went on my run and talk to my friend, which I was like, oh, yes, I just love being outside so much. All right, thank you, everyone, for listening to another episode of Quick to Listen. Ted, it's been great to have you on. Ben, thank you so much for making it work with us all the way from Beijing. This podcast is produced by myself, Richard Clark, and Cray Allred. You can support the podcast by going to orderct.com/quick to listen and become a subscriber, or you can go onto Apple Podcasts and you can rate and review the podcast and give us your feedback. That really helps a lot. We will see you all next week.